We're learning about a rural affordable workforce housing initiative in the northern reaches of our state on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So this is the work of WEDA, the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, put together a $10 million housing pilot plan that is underway in some of the northern reaches of our state, as I said. Have you left a job because you couldn't find adequate and affordable housing? Do you hire seasonal workers with barriers to housing? What do you do to help? What ways can the state step up to address this issue? 800-642-1234. Anna Simpson is Director of Community and Economic Development at WEDA, the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. Anna, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me on the Morning Talk Show.
Good morning. Let's start with terminology. What exactly qualifies as workforce housing? What does that mean?
Workforce housing is for individuals that wouldn't have to pay anywhere between 60 to 120% of their county median income. And at the end of the day, our goal is to not have to have someone pay more than 30% of their salary towards their housing expenses. So workforce housing is just that, housing for our workforce.
We've heard that 30% rule, if you will, that mantra of you trying not to spend over 30% of your take-home pay on housing. So how is workforce housing different from, say, subsidized low-income housing or housing voucher programs?
It's a different concept. The workforce housing is specific to the project. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about multifamily, or in the case of single family homes. So for example, unlike the voucher program, workforce housing can be single family home ownership. So there are programs that exist where if someone is in that salary range of workforce housing, you can qualify to receive, for example, down payment assistance. We now know that one of the biggest barriers to home ownership is being able to save enough money for down payments, especially with the cost of homes rising. So depending on your salary range, you may qualify for down payment assistance. You may qualify for certain programs that can help you get into a home. So again, workforce housing isn't just specific to vouchers that travel with a person. It's larger than that, and it does encompass both rental housing mm-hmm. and also homeownership.
Anna, there was that Commission for Rural Prosperity that was created by Governor Evers, and it found a significant shortage of rural workforce housing in parts of our state. Why is the workforce housing shortage of special concern in rural areas?
I think that there are several factors that have attributed to the shortage of workforce housing, specifically in certain areas in rural Wisconsin. We've held several statewide listening sessions, and there are definite common themes that have arisen from those discussions. And those themes have pointed to the cost of construction, so rising construction costs. There tends to be limited developer interest due to economies of scale in rural communities. There's an aging housing stock. There are few affordable rental options. There are zoning and infrastructure challenges. And also there's some limited financing for new construction and renovation projects. Those tend to be the common themes that that have attributed to the issues in workforce housing in rural communities.
Multiple issues going on. Anna Simpson with mm-hmm. us, Director of Community and Economic Development at the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. As we explore WEDA's efforts to address workforce housing in rural parts of the state, do you live and work in a rural area? Have you moved to a city for a job? Have you moved into Wisconsin for work? Do you struggle to find affordable housing near your work? 800-642-1234. And I'm thinking about the thousands of seasonal workers who come from around the world every spring to the Wisconsin Dells area. The Hiawatha Residence Hall was built in Lake Delton in 2014. So dorm-like style housing helps to accommodate the international workforce especially. What are the different models of workforce housing, and how do you see what is happening in the Dells fitting into the larger picture here of seasonal workers?
There are several different models that exist today, but what I will say is that through our Rural Affordable Workforce Housing Initiative, that's part of the work that the communities that are going through the pilots are exploring, is looking at what currently exists, is it working, and what other models are out there. There's precedents across the nation, and everyone in many ways, we're in the same boat. So we're really trying to learn from one another. And one of the things that the communities are doing are exploring what models have occurred in other parts of the country that make sense here in Wisconsin. And are there ways to combat some of the barriers that I mentioned before? So for example, I talked about the cost of construction. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the models that exist in other places? So whether it's tiny homes, modular homes, et cetera, right? So going through the pilot community process, they're exploring, you know, what are other models? Because again, we do have solutions already that exist in the state, but we still have a problem. So the pilot process is really looking at what can we explore that's different than what we've already been doing that starts to tackle some of these issues.
Would this dorm style building type of project be one type of thing you would be exploring?
That really is dependent on the community. So, right. So at the end of the day, going through the Rural Affordable Workforce Housing Initiative, that process is a human-centered design, and it's about going to the lived experience users, the community in this case, to dictate what are their specific needs, right? Mm. So unlike maybe approaches from the past where WIDA or other partners, the developers, et cetera, that they would drive what the solutions are, through the Rural Affordable Workforce Housing Initiative, the pilot communities are driving the solutions. So at the end of the day, they are looking for what their needs are, but also at the same time, keeping in mind what are solutions that are replicatable across the state of Wisconsin, because we do have, you used Wisconsin Dells as an example, but one of our pilot communities is Door County. Mm-hmm. That's also very much affected, right, by a seasonal workforce. So again, what are solutions that are replicatable to other rural communities across the state of Wisconsin?
And as you mentioned, looking at what other states have doing, what other places around the country have doing, I've had an eye on the Lake Tahoe area and what Lake Tahoe has been doing with this type of workforce housing, very much in the same boat. You have really high housing costs and you still have a workforce that needs to live near where they work. And I'm wondering, what is the role of companies and employers as you look at the partners at the table? What do the businesses bring to this?
That is a great question, Kate. And I also jotted down the Lake Tahoe area. I want to make sure that we've been using some precedents from that area. So that's a great tip. But in terms of the employers, at the end of the day, access to safe, affordable shelter is fundamental to sustainability of our communities. And you hear so much about the social determinants of health, and housing security is a critical piece of just our overall health and holistic wellness. And for employers, that is so important because they need local skilled workers, and communities need housing, and they need our businesses for a healthy tax base. So for employers, what couple things. One, we have, through the Rural Affordable Workforce Housing Initiative, we have several employers that have stepped up to be a part of the process. And that is so important because, again, they are part of that ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And it may feel different, but they truly are. And at the end of the day, it really takes so many partners to make this work. It's not just the local government, whether it's the county or the city or town. It's not just WIDA or another partner. It takes all of us to start to tackle some of these issues. And employers truly are a critical piece of that. I'm sure you've heard of employers paying stipends, for example, yes. mm-hmm. to employees, correct? Mm-hmm. I always think about, well, what's the power and leverage? Could that investment in their workforce be utilized in partnership with other sources, right? And the leverage, what could that do? So it's about thinking differently. It's about innovation. And that truly is why we invested in this process, so that we can start coming up with solutions that, again, are different and may feel different, but it really does include everyone that is part of that community that is willing to step up, to start thinking differently, start determining what are those needs specific to that community. But again, employers are a critical piece of that.
Anna Simpson with us, working on affordable workforce housing, that issue for WIDA, the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. Do you live in one of the counties, Bayfield, next door in Ashland, perhaps Marinette or Door? What is the rental housing market like? What is the ability to purchase a home like? Have there been efforts in your community to provide seasonal housing to workers in an industry like tourism or agriculture? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Anna Simpson here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing challenges with finding housing in the area you live and work on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For communities all over the map, the problem attracting workers and workforce development goes hand in hand with affordable housing. The Urban Land Institute says diversity is the hallmark of a healthy and balanced community, and that means having a variety of housing types appropriate for residents in all stages of life. How do you define affordable housing? What is your community doing to address this issue? It's 800-642-1234. Anna Simpson is Community and Economic Development Director for WIDA, the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, with us for about 8 more minutes. So explain why were Door County, Marinette County, and the Shawamigan Bay Area chosen for this initiative?
Thank you, Kate. The pilot design process included 3 phases, research and engagement, ideation, and implementation. It also is part of a greater initiative that includes supplemental financing tools. So part of that is we updated our housing tax credit allocation plan to help more rural projects qualify, developing new multifamily housing gap financing to help more rural projects advance, and expanding our first-time homebuyer down payment assistance program, which is called Easy Close. As far as the 3 communities that were selected, participation attracted a strong interest throughout the entire state, and the selection process was rigorous and highly competitive. But the 3 pilot communities shared common traits, including collaboration among local government and private sector entities, as well as proven groundwork on the issues surrounding affordable housing, including an initial investment in a regional housing study. So the communities that were selected were based on criteria, including the demonstrated need for workforce housing and the understanding of their local or regional housing gap, the existing momentum that they had within the community related to workforce housing, commitment from local employers, government entities, and others to ensure close collaboration throughout the pilot process and implementation, the assessment of need, presence of other community resources and land use, and then finally, new housing and rehabilitation criteria that can provide for leverage. So we looked at the definition also of rural taken from the USDA. So the communities needed to be in a rural county, which more than 25% of their residents reside in a rural area under the standards established by USDA.
Okay, so really a lot of qualifications there. Talking with Anna Simpson, Director of Community and Economic Development at Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, working on initiatives around affordable housing and hearing your questions, 800-642-1234. Christiane is joining us from Racine. Christiane, hi, go ahead.
Hi, actually it's Christian. But
oh, Christian, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I know a couple of years ago, some legislators, it was Francesca Hong and Christina Shelton, tried to put forth an economic justice bill of rights in the assembly. And of course, it didn't get much further than that. But I was wondering if your guest has any comment on kind of where that idea was going, or whether or not they're trying to implement those ideas, you know, outside of actually having legislation. One of the tenets of that was having, high quality, safe housing available to the residents of Wisconsin.
So very good question here. How does this translate, this type of work translate into policy, into legislation, Anna?
That is a really great question. Thank you. So going through this process again, as I mentioned before, we're really trying to be innovative and look for solutions that are replicatable. I'm not familiar with the bill that this gentleman, Christian, mentioned, but at the end of the day, we're looking for solutions that are replicatable. And if at the end of the day, going through the process identifies that there is something maybe on the legislative side that should be worked on, that is something that obviously then we could elevate and bring to the administration, should that be something that is uncovered during the process.
We have an email here from Kathy to suggest a workforce housing development to look at in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And Kathy said that resorts there come together to build workforce housing. And Kathy's wondering, is that happening in Wisconsin at all? Have you heard of programs like this?
That is a really good question, Kathy. And Jackson Hole is a beautiful area. I've been there. I am not familiar if there is that type of work happening with resorts coming together. That is something that we can most certainly look into. I'd be curious to see if there could be potentially something happening like that in the Dells area already. Not sure, but that is a great suggestion and something that we can dig into a little bit further.
So what is the timeline for this Rural Affordable Housing Initiative project? What happens next?
So for the Rural Affordable Workforce Housing Initiative, our next steps are finishing up the process with the three pilot communities. So in the months ahead, Door County pilot team, along with WEDA and other community partners, will be working to launch and implement some of the pilot solutions that address the core areas that we discussed today. They are in that implementation phase. Marinette is wrapping up with ideation, and Shawamagon Bay actually is participating in their research and engagement kickoff yesterday and today. So for example, the kickoff and engagement or the research and engagement process is about a 6 to 8 month process. Mm-hmm. So we will be in this work through the end of this year into next year as well. And again, it's going through each community, through each of those three phases that I had indicated. But what I would encourage folks to do is to visit WEDA.com. There is a landing page in our About section that is titled Rural Workforce Housing. There you can follow what's happening in all three communities and see the timeline of where we're at and what's left to do in those communities and what has occurred and what's going to be coming up.
So you can really keep tabs on that. Only a couple seconds left here, but what defines success for this project?
For success for this project, at the end of the day, is finding new solutions that are replicatable that lead to additional housing. Mm. And because at the end of the day, the reason why we started doing this work is to ensure that we are creating more housing. So that is the end goal, is that we find solutions that lead to more housing, and that at the same time, there are solutions that are replicatable and can be used by other rural communities across the state of Wisconsin.
Anna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Anna Simpson, Director of Community and Economic Development at the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. Ahead this hour, some school districts saw record high enrollment last year for summer school. How are they preparing for this year? We talk with the Racine Unified School District. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a look into how Wisconsin became the Badger State.
We recently received a listener question in the Wisconsin mailbag. Michael from Dane County asked, why is the badger Wisconsin state animal? WPR's John K. Wilson went digging to find out more.
Wisconsin is the Badger State. It's on the flag, it's the mascot of the state's biggest university, and back in 1957, lawmakers put the badger into state law as Wisconsin's official animal. But why? Badgers live in plenty of states, and they're pretty rare here. It's not like you see them running around willy-nilly like squirrels. To get some answers, I figured why not start by going straight to the source. Bucky, pretty common name for badgers, I guess, is the resident education badger at Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison. He goes on field trips and teaches kids about nature, so maybe he'd have something to tell me. On a recent morning, I talked with him in his enclosure while he was eating a hard-boiled egg. Hi, Bucky. John K. Wilson with WPR. Can I ask you a few questions? Do you know why the badger is Wisconsin's state animal? Any idea why you're on the state flag? I've seen this type before. Cute, but not a talker. Clearly, I needed someone with some more specialized knowledge.
My name is Jim Leary, and I'm a retired faculty at UW-Madison in Folklore and Scandinavian Studies.
Leary studies the history and culture of Midwestern people. He said the whole Wisconsin badger thing comes down to
lead mining in the late 1820s and into the 1830s and beyond in the southwest part of the state.
Yeah. Lead mining.
In lead mining, there were little holes that people started to dig in and sometimes abandon, and they were called, you know, sometimes called badger holes. But the prevailing story is that the early settlers actually lived in these holes, and that's where the name came from.
Turns out, though, that probably never happened. Leary says historians can't find any reliable evidence that miners actually lived in their badger holes. But either way, the name stuck. So, to boil it down, the badger is Wisconsin's state animal because 200 years ago, people here went digging for lead. And actual badgers also dig holes?
He is a great digger. He's got those really long front claws that are fantastic at digging burrows really quickly.
Back at the zoo, curator Jess Thompson had plenty of other good facts about real badgers like Bucky and his cousins in the wild.
There are a couple different types of badgers. There are badgers that live in Europe, European badgers. There's obviously the honey badger that many people know about in Africa. And there are some badgers that live in Asia. And most of those species are much more social, but our North American badgers are really solitary.
Thompson says badgers are ferocious hunters.
They also have jaws that are really hard to dislocate because of the way that they're attached in their skull. So because of that, they're able to attach really firmly onto their prey.
But aside from hunting prowess and a shared history of digging, is there something about badgers that makes them a good symbol for Wisconsin?
Definitely. Yeah, these guys are so resourceful, and they're known for being tough and being able to make it through a lot of different circumstances. So a lot of great qualities.
John K. Wilson is a digital editor at WPR and is the co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. And this story came to us from a listener question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now we're discussing K-12 learning gaps and the role of summer coursework. Last summer, news reports recognized that the state's largest school district, Milwaukee Public Schools, had record summer school attendance. About 25 miles due south, we find out how the Racine Unified School District is preparing for this summer. Was your child invited to attend summer school? Are they going? What barriers stand in the way for your family to participate? If your child went to summer school before, was it worth it? Did it help? 800-642-1234. Janelle Decker is Deputy Chief Academic Officer for the Racine Unified School District. Janelle, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. Can you start with some numbers for us? How many students enrolled last summer? How does that compare to what you see from families heading into this summer with invitations to attend summer school?
We had about 2,700 total students enroll, and we are expecting that we have about the same, if not a little more, because of the trajectory of who's registering right now. It's a big community need to have something over the summer for the kids.
How do you choose the students to invite? What benchmarks do you use? What do you look at?
We invite everybody.
Okay.
Our summer school is really well-rounded. We make sure that we have academic options, but also more enrichment options. So a STEM, STEAM, science option, Phi-Ed, music, art. We have a fun social studies course. So it doesn't have to be just focused on reading and math. A student can come in and enjoy the entire day in different types of enrichment options.
So how does summer school differ for younger students versus high school students?
High school is more focused around credit recovery.
Okay.
So if they have failed a course and they need to make that up in order to graduate by the end of the summer, that is where the majority of the students from high school, that's kind of their situation. And then in the younger grades, it's focused more on reading and math courses if they do need some help building those skills or a bunch of fun courses too.
What have you seen by way of learning loss in the pandemic? What does it look like in your district?
We're pretty similar to all the districts across the country. So we did see learning loss, and it's impacted our students anywhere from, I would say, 1 to 3 years, depending on how well they attended our virtual options. And then when we did come back in person, if they could attend in person on a regular basis as well. So summer school is an opportunity to have really small class sizes. We cap our academic courses at 15, so they get a lot of teacher attention. And it's a big benefit for any family and any student that maybe isn't very comfortable in their skills and they feel kind of lost in the larger class sizes during the school year. They can come into summer school, have more of a comfortable number of peers in that class, and get a lot more one-on-one attention.
When you say 1 to 3 years, do you mean that your students have fallen behind 1 to 3 academic grades in the pandemic, that you're seeing that trend?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. That's really scary.
It is. It is. So we have a lot of interventions that we're putting in place during the school year. And then, of course, summer school is there, too, to support all that learning that happened during the school year over the summer. We recognize that a lot of the research shows that there is more learning loss that happens over the summer, especially with low-income families. And that learning loss, unfortunately, is cumulative. So they could fall a year behind maybe by the time they're sixth grade from their middle income peers just because of the summer learning loss.
If your child has an individualized education program, or an IEP is the acronym we hear often, can they receive special education services during the summer school, or how does that work?
Absolutely. So if they do have something called ESY, extended school year, written into their IEP, they will have specific special ed services during the summer provided to them. And if they just have an IEP that does not have summer specific services, they are more than welcome, and they do join any of our other courses that are available.
Do you have ever concerns about more students eligible or available to wanting spots open, or do you have ample space and teachers to accommodate the need that you see?
We do have ample space, and every single week we're monitoring how many families are registering and for what specific courses they're registering. So we start out by hiring a basic amount of staff, and we have specific set buildings. But if at any time that goes over the capacity that we expect, then we'll open more sites and we will attempt to hire more teachers.
How do you approach wraparound care if a parent is working when summer school lets out?
This summer in particular, we have a new partnership. One of the things that came out of the pandemic is a lot of community partners working together with us to really provide all of the services that our families need because of the impacts of COVID. So this year, our city is partnering with us to bring their Parks and Rec program that they used to have just at our local community centers into our schools. And that we are going to provide free for our families that need that extra care. And that goes from the end of summer school to 5 p.m.
Janelle Decker with us, Deputy Chief Academic Officer for the Racine Unified School District, includes 30 elementary, middle, and high schools. Do you think summer school can help a child develop, or do you worry that it is too much, that there is burnout? Is summer school a safety net of sorts, helping your child continue to catch up from significant learning loss in the pandemic? Still time to share your thoughts on summer school. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Janelle Decker here on the Ideas Network. It's a conversation about summer school on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Brookings issued a report this month that found the pandemic has had devastating impacts on learning. And it asked this central question: what will it take to help students catch up? And they said it's not a, quote, lost generation. We shouldn't give up hope, but the numbers are alarming and potentially demoralizing. Do you think summer school can right the wrongs? What else must happen to get kids back on track? It's 800-642-1234. Janelle Decker, Deputy Chief Academic Officer for the Racine Unified School District, with us for about 10 more minutes. Janelle, you know, President Biden, in his State of the Union, acknowledged the $122 billion from federal relief aid directed at schools, American Rescue Plan, ESSER funds that I'm talking about. How has Racine used federal funds in these times to shore up needs in your district?
We've used that money in a variety of ways. Not only academic, but also for social emotional needs and health needs for the community. So in terms of learning loss, we've hired additional interventionists for reading and math. So students that are falling behind can have more individualized or small group attention. We've hired more educational assistants to help in our youngest grades in kindergarten and first grade. And they've been trained with some of the additional money to help with early literacy skills. Students learn very rapidly in the early years. So we are taking a more of a proactive mindset that we're going to intervene as quickly as possible and try to catch those students up as quickly as possible so that gap doesn't widen as they further their career in RUSD. We have had training for all of our teachers on various technology needs, social emotional needs, and different academic needs, like pacing out our curriculum differently due to what they are seeing in their classrooms right now. And then, of course, we did use them, use the dollars for COVID safety protocols and more social emotional supports in the buildings as well.
I'm hearing more individualized attention, earlier intervention in your approach. Do you think you would have been able to hire these reading and math interventionists or these additional educational assistants were it not for this federal aid? Would you be in the same place?
No, absolutely not. That federal aid has been critical and crucial for us to be able to support students above and beyond how we've been able to in the past. These are all additional supports and additional attention that our kids and our families have never had before. So that money was absolutely necessary for them.
Department of Public Instruction saying districts facing historic teacher shortages, teachers burned out in these times after 2 years in the pandemic. What are you seeing in your district in Racine? How are you dealing with this?
We do see that same trend happening here. We appreciate everything that the teachers have been doing this year. One of the largest reasons why they're burned out is because they've been having to completely retool the way that they've taught for the past 3 years, and they've had to do it in zero time. So just learning and reconfiguring the way that they teach, the way that they assess the students, the additional family engagement and supports that they have to give because of extra trauma or troubles because of COVID. And to top that all off, we had a lot of absences for COVID, and there aren't many substitute teachers. So the time that teachers have, which is already limited during the day for them to prep in order to do their jobs, oftentimes they don't get. So teachers have to prep or have to sub on their prep periods. That means that all of that work that they're doing to prepare for the families and the students is happening before or after school. So very long work days, high stress, just really want what's best for the kids and the families in this community, and it can take a toll.
Are you still seeing that same shortage for substitute teachers?
Yes. We did make some adjustments in our pay, and we took a different angle, and we're trying to hire them more as permanent subs. So it's guaranteed full-time work in specific buildings instead of being called randomly in the morning and going to different sites. So there's different things that we've definitely tried and it's been successful, but even still, yes, there's a shortage. And unfortunately, the teachers pay for that. I've even taken up subbing myself this year.
Talking with the Deputy Chief Academic Officer for the Racine Unified School District, Janelle Decker is here looking at the situation heading into summer. What questions do you have about summer school? Are you a student considering going through summer coursework? Share your experience. Do you think that summer school can help children with these academic gaps that have been caused by the pandemic. 800-642-1234. I want to return to summer school here, and transportation has also been an issue for some districts. How does Racine and, you know, some other districts address barriers to summer school like transportation?
Mm-hmm. Last year, we did have a shuttle, and we had various sites around the summer or around the city in the summer for the families to take advantage of, to shuttle them to a summer school site and drop them off in the afternoon. Unfortunately, it wasn't utilized to the extent that we would have hoped. So this summer, we are reaching out directly to those families. And if they have a transportation need, we're going to work with them on an individualized basis. If we do need to have one of our district vans, shuttles, any of our buses, if we need to set that up, we will. If we need to provide free bus passes, we will. So we're taking a different angle, but we don't ever want transportation to be a barrier. We'll work with every individual family to make sure that they can make it to summer school if they want to participate.
That is a lot of logistics planning. Is your district prepared for trying to navigate those logistics, especially when you have multiple families needing transportation?
Yes, absolutely. We've been planning routes. And like I said, we had them last summer, too. We start planning for summer school in October. Hmm. So we are definitely prepared for any type of need that comes up. We have different plans for whatever that may be.
I want to land on social emotional here for a moment, because families may be concerned the child attending is feeling isolated from siblings who are going to summer camps and having experiences outside of summer school. What advice do you have for a family with children who aren't attending summer school that they relate to the child who is and support them?
I would say that if there's anything that they can do to encourage just conversation or modeling of what that older sibling had learned, that would really help that younger sibling a lot. So if there was a specific activity they did that they can come and do with that younger sibling at home, encourage them to do that. If there are certain books that they might have read and they're basing some activities off of, maybe just recap those activities with the sibling at home. A lot of it is just sharing daily experiences and getting the younger kids excited and wanting to participate in some sort of summer activity that I think is most important.
Janelle, thank you for joining us.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
Janelle Decker is Deputy Chief Academic Officer for the Racine Unified School District. Just ahead, we talk with a New Yorker cartoon caption contest winner who hails from Mount Horeb and a professor who developed the algorithm that helps the magazine determine what is funny. We go inside the world of New Yorker cartoon captions with your questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.